Crystal Circuit. Hear me. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Zinksheim, consolidated with the mandamus petition in the matter of the United States. Mr. Jean Pietro.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Gordon Jean Pietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney and I represent the United States in these matters. In this case, because of its newly adopted standing order, the district court refused to rule on a motion for downward departure for substantial assistance because the United States refused to turn over its internal deliberations relating to that motion. As a result, the defendant received no sentencing credit for the assistance that he provided, which led to the successful prosecution of five other individuals. Instead of the proposed 15-month sentence, the defendant received a 26-month sentence at the high end of the applicable guideline range. This appeal, then, represents the United States' challenge to the requirements of the standing order, as well as the sentence in Mr. Zinksheim's case.
Mr. Jean Pietro, I take it you see the standing order as an all-or-nothing proposition, or are you looking at individual parts of it? In your brief, you indicate, for example, that the timing and separate motion parts are not as objectionable.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are portions, as we've indicated in our brief, of the standing order that we could live with on a continuing basis. Other portions of it, particularly paragraph 3 and its subparts, are portions that we feel are objectionable in toto. The district court's stated justification for its standing order included really two bases. One, the courthouse rumor mill, through which it heard, allegedly, that there were client agencies of the United States that were unhappy with downward departure decisions. And second, a concern for increased scrutiny by Congress and the Sentencing Commission as it relates to downward departures. To respond to those concerns, the district court suggested that there was a need for transparency in how this process is conducted. And from the United States' perspective, the transparency rationale is both unprecedented, and it is also a rationale that has no principled limit. Indeed, there's no reason why this transparency principle should not apply to other decisions of the United States, for example, at the charging stage, at the plea negotiation stage.
But, you know, the difference is that there's no de novo review in the Court of Appeals of charging decisions of the U.S. Attorney. The law is well established that the government charges what it wants to charge, whereas if you read 5K1.1, it indicates that the court may depart from the guidelines. It doesn't say the court must depart from the guidelines upon motion of the government. And as you know, standards of judicial review, and I'm assuming for the sake of argument here, by the way, that nothing dramatic happens in Booker and Fanfan and that we're actually dealing with a known quantity. But where is the court to turn for the information that would enable it to make a reasoned decision and then in turn would enable the Court of Appeals to make a rational review of a ruling on a 5K1.1 motion?
From our perspective, Your Honor, there are really two categories of information that the standing order is directed towards. One, or maybe I should back up a second, appropriate for the district court to consider with respect to whether a particular defendant has in fact provided substantial assistance are the facts of that cooperation and what in fact the defendant has done as well as his truthfulness. The category of information that the standing order seeks is something far different from that. It is, in fact, the internal deliberations and analysis and evaluation of that information that was conducted by the executive branch. So it's the United States' position that even with de novo review, it would not be appropriate for even this court to review the motivations or deliberations of the executive branch. As this court knows, in the context of the United States' refusal to file a downward departure motion, the only level of review is if there is some constitutionally suspect reason.
Is this the only court that imposes anything like this?
Yes, Your Honor. None of the other district court judges have adopted a similar standing order.
In the Eastern District?
In the Eastern District and, to my knowledge, across the country.
And you mentioned in your brief that the Solicitor General approved this procedure that you're going through right now.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So it's a case then, apparently this is unique around the country, this procedure for...
Yes, Your Honor, that is our understanding, yes.
Is there any rule or whatever that would require some consistency in the district or anywhere else in this procedure?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, except for the consistency of applying the privileges that we believe the United States is entitled to. So, for example, this privilege, this deliberative process privilege, work product privilege, and so forth, are obviously privileges we would be asserting in whatever district this issue may or may not arise. So, no, I don't think there's a uniformity outside of those protections that we'd be seeking, no.
But, of course, what you're saying seems to go much more to... I'm looking at, I can't remember which version, this might be from Moore, five subparts of Part 3 of this standing order, and the copy of the statements given by the defendants to components of law enforcement isn't the government's deliberation, nor are transcripts of testimony. It's really more recommendations in the agency and the downward departure committee's proceedings that get to what you're talking about.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So are you also willing to say that the copies of the statements would be, if you will, this raw data that would help the court evaluate whether this was a motion that ought to be granted?
Your Honor, the government, in our briefs, we've taken the position that in particular cases, and you're referring, I think, to subparts A and B, paragraph 3, in particular cases, of course, we would be willing to provide those statements and also perhaps transcripts of testimony on an as-needed basis. There may be circumstances where, in fact, they would be helpful and relevant to the district court, and we'd have no objection, obviously, in providing them because, at the end of the day, Your Honor, it's the government's desire to have the motion granted. The 5K process or the substantial assistance process works if the government is able to utilize it to the advantage both of defendants and, obviously, to the government in prosecuting other criminals. So,
sure. I mean, it's one arrow in the quiver that the government has. You can also charge differently or you can also do other things. It's certainly, though, an option.
Judge, you raise a point that I think is in the brief of the amici, which I think is one that I have to address, and that is this question of charge bargaining at the front end of a prosecution. As this court is likely aware, the Ashcroft Memorandum specifically precludes the United States from charge bargaining. And the rationale for that is that if the guidelines are to work as Congress intended, there must be some uniformity and consistency and, in fact, transparency across defendants. It is precisely at the substantial assistance point where there can be distinguishing decisions between particular defendants. So the notion that we can charge bargain, I think, is one that's not an option for the United States. It would cut against the purposes of the guidelines. With respect to the transparency rationale that the district court has proposed, I don't want to sound flip in saying this, but the implication is there's no reason why it could not apply to other branches of government, for example. Why wouldn't it be of some interest to the public to know the internal deliberations of this court or any judge with his particular or her particular law clerks?
But, you know, to be quite blunt, it seemed to me what was going on, which is not to say whether it should have been going on or anything, I don't mean to prejudge any point here, but was the fact that the Department of Justice is keeping close track of what district judges are giving which departures when, and there's this thought abroad that, you know, maybe some of them are being quote-unquote soft, and the district judge is responding by saying, okay, you know, let's have a big record here then so that anybody can see why I did it or why I didn't.
Well, there are sort of two responses to that, Your Honor. The first one is with respect to the executive branch's reporting requirements to Congress, it specifically carves out 5K1.1. We have to report other downward departures. We don't have to report 5K1.1 departures because, of course, it's presumed it has to be done at the government's insistence. So with respect to the reporting as to 5K1.1, that concern is not apparent. Secondly, and again to stress the point, there's no effort here to withhold important and relevant facts from the district court with respect to the substantial assistance of a particular defendant. What we are seeking to shield are, in fact, the deliberations of the office in deciding which defendant receives credit and how much. So I understand there's a concern with heightened scrutiny, and that's appropriate to ask for a complete record. It's our position, however, that that record cannot include otherwise privileged information.
Counsel, I have three concrete questions. One, did you ask the district court to reconsider this standing order after the Supreme Court's Cheney decision?
We did not, Your Honor.
The second question is, did you ever draw to the attention of the district court the requirements of the Rules Enabling Act?
We did not, Your Honor.
Third, what is it concretely that you want from the petition for mandamus?
Your Honor, concretely what we would like is the standing order vacated in complete part.
How does one vacate a standing order? The writ of mandamus compels district judges to take non-discretionary acts, such as applying 5K1.1 or awarding a discount. And I don't see how the writ of mandamus authorizes a court of appeals to issue what might better be described as a writ of erasure.
Well, it may be, Your Honor, that...
Do you have any authority for the proposition that mandamus can be used to affect standing orders or rules of court or something like that?
I do not, Your Honor. And I think what's important here, though, is that the government's position is one way or the other in the scope of this direct appeal or in mandamus, we need this standing order examined and vacated to the extent that it seeks privileged information. So to
and
the extent...
You obviously have never asked the Judicial Council of the Seventh Circuit to do anything about the standing order. I mean, one might think of standing orders or rules of court as the administrative side of the court, and it's clear under the Rules Enabling Act that the body with authority over them is not the Court of Appeals, but the Judicial Council of the Circuit. Right? What the Court of Appeals does is order, is deal with judicial acts, like what is this person's sentence, but not with the administrative side. So it's not clear to me that your petition for mandamus is procedurally correct or even in the proper body.
Your Honor, that may very well be correct, and I think one of the reasons the United States proceeded under both direct appeal and by mandamus is to ensure that one way or the other we had this issue reviewed by this court. And so respectfully, I would ask that the court entertain the direct appeal and perhaps also entertain the mandamus petition. But if I'm incorrect, this court is not able to entertain the mandamus petition at the very least. For purposes of the United States and for Mr. Zingsheim, we ask that you do so in the context of these direct appeals. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Mascanola?
May it please the court. My name is Craig Mastantuno. I represent Philip Zingsheim in this appeal. Philip Zingsheim requests that this court, respectfully requests that this court remedy the defective sentence imposed in his case. And the remedy that Mr. Zingsheim seeks in this case is remand with direction that there be a hearing forthwith on the government's motion for downward departure based upon his substantial assistance and resentencing consistent with the outcome of that hearing. Mr. Zingsheim additionally requests that this court also remand with direction that the case be transferred to another court for that determination. The remedy
you mean
sought
another court or another district judge?
To another district judge.
Yeah.
The remedy sought is the one that will allow Mr. Zingsheim the benefit of the bargain that he entered into when he agreed to cooperate with the government investigation and when he agreed to plead guilty in his case. There's obviously a dispute, Your Honors, between the government and the district court involved in this case regarding downward adjustments and what data should be submitted as a matter of policy on all of those motions before that district court. That broader dispute arose...
Well, you keep saying district court. You obviously mean district judge, and that's also the burden of one of the questions I asked the United States. One might think that when a single district judge issues what amounts to a rule of court, that there's a problem under the Rules Enabling Act, which says that rules of court shall be adopted by a majority of all district judges. There's no Lone Ranger permission in the Rules Enabling Act.
I stand corrected to that point, Your Honor. I do mean the district judge.
And there one might think further that questions under the Rules Enabling Act logically come ahead of the constitutional arguments that are being raised in this case. If this rule is irregular, let us say, for reasons this court gave in In re Dorner, which have never been discussed by the parties or the district court, there's obviously no need to discuss any constitutional considerations.
That may be. The remedy, Your Honor, with regard to Mr. Zengsheim, is one that we seek in the direct appeal. The broader disputes between the district judge and the government in this case may take some time to resolve. There may be further appeals beyond the ruling of this court in these matters. That would render an unfair result for Mr. Zengsheim as it applies to his case. Mr. Zengsheim asked for relief in his direct appeal so that his sentence can be determined now and with finality. My client truly is caught in the crossfire of this broader dispute between the district judge and the government. Both the government and the defense agreed at the sentencing hearing that the information presented in support of the motion for townward departure was accurate information. The district judge did not question the accuracy of that information, nor did the judge question whether the criteria for downward departure pursuant to 5K1.1 were met by the information presented in support of the motion for downward departure. Instead, the judge refused to consider the information entirely because the government did not present it in compliance with the standing order that had previously been enunciated.
When you ask for a remand for a hearing, what would be the subject of the hearing? Would it be the same type of hearing?
It would
already
be
had only with a ruling, or would it be? Could it include all the things that Judge Stadler wanted in the first place?
I think it could include whatever the parties submit, but what the hearing that I anticipate, Your Honor, is a hearing on whether or not Mr. Zengsheim is entitled to substantial assistance, downward departure. That hearing never took place because of the refusal to consider the information that was put before the district judge. The district judge never considered that information because it didn't comply with the requirements of the standing order. So the hearing has never taken place. Judgment has entered. A lengthier sentence, I don't think anybody would purport before this court that that anything but a lengthier sentence was the result of the refusal to consider that information, and Mr. Zengsheim now sits and awaits service of that sentence. So I do anticipate a downward departure hearing for substantial assistance and resentencing. That's not taken place, and there's no provision in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure for what happened, for entry of this judgment without consideration of that motion. I can't stress enough that in an adversarial process, we place the task of seeking truth in our most important matters of life and death, in this adversarial process. And when an independent magistrate fails or refuses to consider information or the impact of information presented to it by either or both of the parties in that adversarial process.
I think we have your position. We do need to hear from Mr. Gimbel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Gimbel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. My name is Franklin Gimbel. I appear here today as a friend of Judge Stadmiller to respond to the attempt by the government to seek this court's issuance of a writ of mandamus. I think Judge Woodbury articulately laid out in an opinion adopted by this court on September 12, 2003, the criteria for issuing a writ of mandamus, and in the In re Ford decision, Judge Wood said for the court that a writ may issue only if, and there are thereafter stated three criteria. One is the unreviewability of the end of the case of the issue that is raised in the mandamus. Clearly, today, the companionship of the appeal in this case with the writ of mandamus shows that there is an opportunity for a remedy in the case in which it is claimed that Judge Stadmiller created hurdles to the operation of the court's exercising its discretion to grant a downward departure. This court should be mindful of the fact that at no time did Judge Stadmiller deny the motion of the government to downwardly depart in Mr. Zinshine's case or in any other case.
But he effectively did so when final judgment was entered. I mean, you can sit on things or
another sentence.
Yeah, and the sentence was entered. Your point is, once the sentence is entered on appeal, people appeal all the time because they don't like the sentence that they got. And if the reason is the standing order, then that could be raised, whether on an enabling act theory or any other theory.
That's accurate. And also, I think that it is not unusual. In fact, I find in my practice experience that it is rather usual for the government to come in after a sentencing and bring a Rule 35 motion for the court to consider substantial assistance because there's a performance.
But that's
issue.
Only for substantial assistance after sentencing.
Yeah, I understand.
There's no claim that Zing Shine has provided substantial assistance after sentencing.
He wasn't provided anything.
I mean, both your response and indeed the district judge's statements seem to assume that even after sentencing, a district judge could reduce a sentence, could revisit the substantial assistance issue and reduce the sentence. And under Rule 35, that's just not allowed. I mean, it's now or never. It's before the sentence or never.
Well, I've never understood it to be that way, Judge Easterbrook.
Take a look at Rule 35A.
That the government come in.
The district judge cannot change a sentence more than 7 days after its imposition on any ground other than A, an order from the Court of Appeals, or B, a request from the U.S. attorney based on substantial assistance that post-dates sentencing. The rule could not possibly be clearer.
Right. The judge in this case, however, did not literally deny the motion of the government.
Well, that's true, but I'm just saying, why did we care about that? He ignored it. There's the sentences there, and one has to decide whether it's a lawful sentence. And actually, one has to decide whether this is one of those areas where mandamus might be appropriate in the exercise of this court's supervisory jurisdiction if a district court is, or if a district judge is behaving in an ultra vires manner.
And I'm suggesting that reviewing the criteria for the issuance of a writ of mandamus, that this case doesn't have the threshold criteria that would permit the issuance of a writ. The first prong of which is that they're here on appeal, the second prong of which is the irreparable harm, and the third one is the question of whether or not the activity of the judge that set up this hurdle to the articulation of the government's basis for the downward departure gets into, I think, a dialogue that occurred with Mr. Jim Petro and Your Honor relative to the question of where is the court to turn if the court is to make a decision that is reasoned, that is articulated, and that has a factual basis for review and or justification to the public. And after
but
all,
why is the written report? I mean, it seems to me the core of the government's objections on the merits are C, D, and E of Part 3. Why does the court need the written report from the Downward Departure Committee? Isn't that internal executive branch discussions where people are going to have differences of opinion and a result emerges, just as this panel may go back and talk about the case and eventually we'll figure out what we want to do with it. And then we explain that result.
Well, first of all, Judge Wood, I don't think that Judge Stadmiller created or suggested how the executive branch of government should approach its responsibility to make a decision about whether or not to seek a downward departure under 5K1. That is a decision within the executive branch of government. If they decide, however, that within the process by which they come to that conclusion, they're going to have a component part that is going to involve the development of information and justification for the position that they take before the court, then I think that it is not inappropriate for the court to inquire about that process that has brought them before the court, seeking the court to exercise the ultimate authority of the sentence. And
what fact relevant to 5K1.1 is illuminated by learning about the discussions inside the committee?
It is not inconsistent with the...
No, what fact is illuminated that we need to evaluate, that this court would need if somebody was complaining about a 5K1.1?
If the two prongs of the motion seeking the court to downwardly depart, one being should the court in fact downwardly depart, and then the second prong being to what extent should the court downwardly depart, it is relevant to the second decision that the court has to make, the degree of departure, as to the information that may be in the body of information that is being used to justify the government coming before the court taking a position on the level of the sentencing guideline range that they want the court to rest with. And I suggest that that involves a factual determinant that may have points of view that the court may want to factor into its deliberations to find that proper place. If the court has the ultimate discretion, what are the issues that are involved? Did the person substantially assist the government?
Do you think, counsel, that Congress could pass a statute saying that when the president recommends legislation to Congress, which is one of his constitutional responsibilities, he shall send to Congress a message stating what the arguments pro and con were in the cabinet, what dissenting votes there were in the cabinet, and what reasons the dissenting cabinet members gave?
Do I think that could happen?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that would be...
In the debate. The legislature had the ultimate decision. But I do think that...
So you think that would be a constitutional statute?
I do.
Red Cheney?
I believe that in the...
Have you read Cheney?
I don't recall Cheney, Your Honor. But I do believe that in the collection of information that provides the predicate for the action that is here at issue, that is the exercise of the sentencing decision of the district court within the body of factual information, that the court, I believe, has a right to inquire about and accumulate in order to support his or her decision on A, whether or not to depart on the grounds that have been asserted, and the level of departure. The court should use a vacuum cleaner and sweep up all the relevant information that it can that will assist it in first making the decision, and I think secondly, from the point of the acceptability of the judge's decision in the eye of the public, that becomes something that the public would have a better sense of the operation of our system of criminal justice. If the court articulates very specific and detailed reasons for decisions that it makes about particular cases that come before it and within which it exercises this very awesome discretion.
Well, as a friend of the court, the whole court, it would seem that you represent your client when you go to get a sentencing, ask for a downward departure, that the inconsistency among judges would be more of a problem than trying to get all this background information, wouldn't it?
You go to the
Eastern District of Wisconsin. You represented yourself as being
yes,
a defense
correct.
Attorney, and have brought,
I am.
And it would seem that depending on the judge you go to, you're going to have to go through a different procedure.
It's possible that I may have to go through some different procedure, but ultimately the burden of providing justification for the request of the government does lie with the government. I nonetheless, if I were representing a person accused of crime and the government were asking the court to consider a 5K1 departure for substantial assistance, I would view it a part of my advocate's responsibilities to accumulate as much information as I could to support the government's request to the court, support it to the extent that the government looks to the court for departure and to the level of departure.
Well, that's assuming that more information is better for you. Obviously, if the government recommends downward departure, you're not going to go in there and argue and say, we need a lot more information. If the judge looks at what the government says and says, okay, that's substantial assistance, and therefore, okay, it would just seem that as a friend of the court, you would not want to go that far.
If I understand your question correctly, it is, would I, as an advocate for a defendant in a case within which the government is seeking a downward departure for substantial assistance, would I challenge the sufficiency of information that the government put forward in their request? Most assuredly, no, I would not.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Gamble.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Jean Pietro.
I want to respond in broad terms to three assertions in the brief of the Amici filed last week. First, the Amici assert that it's appropriate to require the United States to waive privileges whenever it invokes the power of the court. That's an extraordinary assertion, one that certainly would apply to litigants on all sides of issues in criminal and civil cases. And it's not one that I think is appropriate. It simply cannot be correct that it's a lawful condition precedent the filing of a motion to reveal the very deliberations that led to the filing of that motion. Secondly, the amici assert at page 22 of their brief that filing the departure motion puts squarely at issue the deliberative process. That's actually incorrect. What's squarely at issue are the facts and circumstances of the particular individual's cooperation, testimony that is provided in grand jury, at trial, debriefing, and so forth. The deliberative process itself is not squarely at issue. Third, and returning to this question of whether charge bargaining would be appropriate as a substitute for filing downward departure motions, I indicated earlier that would fly in the face of the Ashcroft Memorandum and would undercut the guidelines. I think also critically on this question of transparency, this is exactly contrary to transparency, because if the United States is permitted to charge bargain, not only is the court kept in the dark and the public kept in the dark, this is a totally unacceptable alternative if the concern is one of transparency. So for all of these reasons, Your Honors, the United States respectfully requests that you reverse the judgment and vacate the standing order. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. And Mr. Gimbel, you in particular have our thanks for your assistance to the court. The case is taken under advisement.